Thank you, Gopal. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to be talking about an analysis of bioenergy cropping systems in the Great Lakes region this morning. I'd like to first acknowledge co-authors. Kate Hadley is a recently former grad student from our group. Greg Sanford and Randy Jackson are University of Wisconsin colleagues of mine in the Bioenergy Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And Phil Robertson, who's speaking later today, is a colleague from Michigan State University and also in the GLBRC. The focus of today's symposium here really centers around sustainability, and with that in mind, the objective that I've got for this morning is to evaluate eight cropping systems that we've developed at the center for sustainability attributes. And there's lots of sustainability metrics that are out there. For purposes of today, I'm going to be talking about biomass yield, nitrous oxide flux, net ecosystem greenhouse gas balance, net ecosystem energy balance, and then also net dollars return to land and management. And then at the end, I'm going to try to condense all of them down into three basic indices, looking at dollars per hectare, kilograms of CO2 equivalents per hectare, and then also megajoules per hectare. Looking first at the site, as I mentioned, we have eight cropping systems established, two locations, both at Arlington and then also at Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan. And we have the same systems established at each site. We do use, as a kind of an overlying objective, we try to use local generally accepted management practice. So there are some differences that are mandated just by the difference in location. The different soils, you can see at Arlington, there's a prairie soil, a mollisol, highly productive. And then we've got at KBS an alfasol soil that developed under forest land. The latitudes are pretty similar, but there's quite a significant difference in mean annual temperature. We get a buffering effect from the lake, and you can see that we're some 3 degrees warmer overall than what they are, and that kind of is going to play in to the, I guess, the growth response of some of the crops I'm going to talk about, specifically the miscanthus. So at the end, I'm going to split the two locations apart for that reason. The crops that we have at the center, this particular experiment anyway, we have annuals, continuous corn, and we also have a rotational system where we have entries each year of the corn, soybean, and canola. We also have monocrop perennials of switchgrass, miscanthus, and hybrid poplar. And then we have three polycrop systems, a native grass mix with five native grasses listed there, an old field treatment, which basically is taking what the seed bank gives you, and then a prairie grass mix. The management at all of these treatments receive synthetic fertilizer except the prairie grass mix, which didn't receive any, and that will kind of play in to some of these indices later on that I'll show you. And for today's talk, I'm going to focus on these particular crops where we'll be comparing things to continuous corn. We're in the Great Lakes region, we're close enough to the core of the Midwest that farmers tend to base everything based on corn. And if we're going to make inroads into their cropping systems, we're going to have to compare our crops to corn in order to get them on the land. Also, as you'll notice, there's a gradient here on your left, the low diversity, high input. And you'll notice when I get into particularly some of the modeling work on the inputs, you'll see quite a gradient there. And then on the right-hand side, the high diversity, low input. Jumping right to the results, as far as the yield data, and this is actually harvest at the KBS site. A little hard to see here, but this is our corn crop here, and this is Stover only. And when we add in the grain, you can see it makes a significant difference. This would be switchgrass, and then miscanthus. And you'll note we have a missing data point there in 2010. Even though the crops were started in 2008, we had winter kill of the miscanthus at the Arlington site, which tells us there probably is a northern limit to this crop. It does very well. It has done very well at KBS. And in Michigan, since we've been working with it, we haven't run into that problem. And we've since been able to establish miscanthus at Arlington. But there definitely is an issue there with getting through that first year. Once you get through that first year, it seems to take hold, and it can withstand most of the winters that we've had, at least in the duration of the experiment in the Great Lakes region. I'll now do some paired comparisons on this data, and I'll start with here, looking at our corn grain plus stover with the average of all the biomass crops, and you can see that corn is significantly higher yielding, about 8.4 metric tons per hectare greater. However, when we compare just the corn stover to the average of all the biomass crops, the biomass crops actually are somewhat ahead of just the stover fraction of the corn. Now, the interesting part here, we do have a crop that already can compete with corn, the grain plus stover, and that's been our miscanthus. And this is the average across both locations. And I like to say, you know, corn is a good crop for a reason. It's undergone, by some estimates, 10,000 years of human selection. So we probably have similar gains to be made with some of these bioenergy crops, too. So it is encouraging to see that we have a perennial that will already compete with our corn, the whole plant corn. And then looking at just the corn stover with the native systems, again, no significant difference. Now, looking at the two monocultures of perennial crops that we have, the miscanthus has performed significantly better than the switchgrass in the Great Lakes region. Then looking at the average of the switchgrass and the miscanthus to the polycultures, again, we see a significant advantage there to those monoculture crops. And we'll look at some of the other sustainability attributes in addition to yield, but this is starting to suggest that, at least from a biodiversity standpoint, maybe what we want to be looking at is a biodiverse range of different crops in a landscape instead of trying to put them together in the same area. The thing that always sticks in my mind is a saying that I heard, I won't name who it came from, but was that the biggest, meanest dog usually ends up winning in those polycultures anyway. We haven't seen that. We still seem to have a pretty diverse mix, but at least from a yield standpoint, on this particular type of soil, the monoculture looks pretty good. Then with switchgrass versus the native grass polycultures, the switchgrass has an advantage there as well. So just a couple of quick conclusions here from biomass yield. The perennial biomass crops were competitive with the corn stover for harvested yield. Miscanthus was our most productive perennial crop, and it was, especially on the Michigan side, it actually in last year out-yielded the corn on a whole plant basis, grain plus stover. And then I've already talked about the monoculture of miscanthus and switchgrass being more productive than the polycultures. Okay, the next area I'm going to get into is these net ecosystem balances for both greenhouse gases, and we have some empirical measurements as far as soil carbon and nitrous oxide, and then the model system that I use is also looking at, from the input side, some of the other greenhouse gases. And I'll go through it, the methods with the greenhouse gases, but we did the similar thing with energy. I don't have the time today to go through the same process on the energy, but I will give you the energy results. And the first thing, when you look at these balances, you have to define what your system is, of course. And what we were looking at here was a cradle to field gate boundary, as you can see in the green. So we go all the way back on the cradle side. The model goes back into the raw material extraction, all the way through the manufacture of the materials. Then we look at, as I mentioned, we have nitrous oxide measurements. We have surrogate measurements for the CO2, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. And then our crop residues, of course, and then all the field activities and the production and the harvest. And then to kind of close that loop in the field, we look at fossil fuel displacement. And because these are bioenergy cropping systems, the end result is going to be ethanol. And then for every time that ethanol goes into a gas tank, it's displacing gasoline with autotrophically derived carbon. And as Gopal mentioned this morning, the mention in the IPCC, that's what really gives bioenergy crops distinction as far as being able to help with the whole idea of greenhouse gas production. So that's what we looked at to kind of close that loop. As far as the materials and methods here, material inputs were all the seeds, herbicides, fertilizer, diesel. Non-material inputs were all the field activities. Then these were averaged over the 6 growing seasons for each system. They differed every year. Obviously, with these perennial crops, you've got a lot of field activities early on, less as you get into the maintenance of them. And then with the annuals, you've got a similar thing through every year. And then the fossil fuel offsets were calculated on recorded yields and then based on a 0.7 replacement value of ethanol versus gasoline on an energy basis. As far as the N2O gas flux, standard static chamber gas flux methodology was used. I won't spend a lot of time on that. Most of you are familiar with that. On soil carbon, we made a decision here. I'm not an expert on soil carbon. The way it was explained to me is trying to measure a flea on an elephant. You're looking at very small changes in a short duration of time. And we had the luxury here of having another cropping systems experiment that's in its 20th, over 20 years of data we've got now on that, right adjacent at KBS to where we have the current ones. And we had annuals in there, monocot perennials, and then mixed as well. So we took, we decided to use that surrogate measurement. And we took those figures and applied them in the GABI model to these cropping systems. We just didn't feel comfortable with the 6 years of soil data that we had, even though we were collecting CO2 emissions in addition to the nitrous oxide. As I mentioned, we used this software, German software, GABI. It's basically life cycle analysis software that we use for these net ecosystem balances. To help organize our and inventory all the different impact assessments. And the software contained a database that had all the figures that we needed, for example, like so many hours of a tractor is partitioned to the manufacture cost of that tractor. It goes back to that level of depth. So for the results, this is the results of the field emissions. And to start with here, this is actually cumulative emissions in nitrate nitrogen in kilograms per hectare. And you can see, as we would expect, the continuous corn here is probably the leakiest system we have. As I mentioned, we tailored the management to the local conditions. And the nitrogen application rate ranged at KBS from around 168 kilograms per hectare to 200 kilograms per hectare on the more productive soils in Arlington. The native prairie, as I mentioned, was the only one that did not receive any fertilizer. And you can see the significant difference there between those. When we look at our perennial crops here, there's not a whole lot of difference there between them, and they all received, when they got nitrogen, they all received a flat rate of 56 kilograms per hectare. There were some differences in when they received it. We had a slow start to the switchgrass crops at KBS, so they didn't receive nitrogen the first 2 years. The others, most of the others didn't receive nitrogen in year one, and then the mixed grasses also didn't receive nitrogen in 2 of the 5 years looked at. So that's the basis for some of the differences there. This is the results here that shows the annual emissions attributed to the manufacture and transport of the material inputs that we had. And as I mentioned, corn is on the extreme side as far as high intensity, had the most inputs, and you can see that brought to bear here for the inputs that we looked at. The other thing I want to point out here that's fairly obvious is the nitrogen fertilizer manufacture and transport. And you can see, even though, as I mentioned, these particular crops received the same rate, these didn't, the switchgrass, this is at KBS, the switchgrass and the mixed grass got nitrogen 2 out of 5 years, whereas the miscanthus in the old field got it out of 4 out of 5. And the take home here is nitrogen is very expensive in terms of both energy and carbon and dollars. How much time? 2 minutes? Okay. I'm going to have to pick it up a little bit here. This is the results of then the gross ecosystem annual emissions. You can see here the corn crop far outpaces the rest as far as being leaky in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. This is when we then add the net is the difference between the gray and the green. The gray is the offset from the fuels that are produced at each of these cropping systems. The same was true at KBS, as we saw at Arlington. And on here, I bring energy into the mix. Energy is on the right-hand side. And then this would be the kilogram CO2 equivalents this way. So we want to be up in this quadrant. And as you can see, I split the Wisconsin and Michigan here because of some of those differences I talked about earlier. Corn seems to congregate up here in this corner. As I mentioned, it's a good crop, and yield really drives it in that direction. And then miscanthus at Michigan, KBS, also looks very good in this profile. Because we had a replant at Arlington, it really drove us in the other direction. We had to do those field activities twice, and you get all those associated costs with planting. Factored in as well, drives it towards the right, both in terms of energy and greenhouse gases. So very quickly on here, crop yield, fossil fuel displacement is a dominant positive factor. Yield is very good in these sustainability indices. Nitrous oxide flux and then also the manufacturer cost is a big negative. We had the nitrous oxide emissions highest from the corn, lowest from unfertilized prairie, and then the lack of a harvestable yield in year one really negatively affects perennial crops, and then conversely the lack of the planting helps them in the following years. Quickly on the dollars here, I won't spend a lot of time. A lot of the published here back in 2010, a lot of the methods, we basically set up 10-year crop budgets and then average them out. This is how they come out looking. Corn grain, pretty good net returns. Then split out the miscanthus. This is the average miscanthus, and then the Michigan. Michigan looks pretty favorable, and this is a scenario we used in the paper described that with the cheaper rhizomes. We now get them for 30 cents a rhizome, where when we started the experiment, they were over $2 a rhizome. So my summary conclusions, I said I can condense them down here. Corn grain here, everything here but corn grain is set equal to 1. So this is our basis for comparison. Our miscanthus average here, then our Michigan miscanthus, you can see we actually were a little bit lower on the energy. Starch has a lot of energy in it, but we are better in terms of dollars and CO2 equivalents per hectare. So yield's a big driver, go back to that, and the sustainability indices. Miscanthus looks pretty good, but we are concerned about some of the long-term sustainability with that as far as biodiversity, particularly genetic biodiversity. Many are familiar with that. And then again, I want to emphasize, these were done on relatively productive soils. We really need to take this work on some of the marginal lands where we're going to be moving to in the future. And my colleague is going to talk a little bit about some of the potential on marginal soils later this afternoon. Acknowledgements here, and I guess with that, I'm all set.
Thank you.